Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disadvantages and disabilities who have had taken from them or have been denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those about them. OCAP was at Queen's Park Friday, April 1st. Disrespect was there. 250 volunteers marched from Hamilton, from Toronto, and simultaneously in Sudbury and Kingston. In Toronto, from Nathan Phillips Square to Queen's Park to protest the narrowing of the special diet and the ridiculous 1% increase in income for people on social assistance, which marks the 20th year. People on social assistance incomes, including people with disabilities, have had their incomes cut each year. OCAP is quite reasonably asking for a 55% increase in the workfare income to match the levels of 1995 when they were cut by the Harris government by 21.6%. Today they stand at $592 a month. We don't have an interview from that demonstration. However, we do have a previous interview with John Clark. The points made in that previous interview are even more imperative today. Listen to John Clark of OCAP on Disrespect. Disrespect welcomes to the show today John Clark from OCAP to speak about the rally for the special diet benefit and progress being made. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
The government seems to have made a prescriptive answer to this, as if medicine, number one, knew everything about what made people ill and what kind of nutrition they needed to stay well, or not even that, because apparently they're not doing anything preventive, but what kind of nutrition they needed to regain their health. And what they don't know isn't worth anybody talking about it. In fact, everybody's forbidden from talking about it now.
Right. Well, I think the response of the Liberal government to the crisis, from their point of view, that emerged around the special diet supplement, really has nothing to do with medicine, nothing to do with healthcare. In fact, it has everything to do with jeopardizing people's health. But they've come up with a really crude rationalization of their real intention, which is to preserve income support programs in this province as a means of channeling people into the lowest paying worst jobs on offer,
and keeping the income support low so it continues to do that.
Precisely. I mean, the fact is that we were responding to a situation where in the last 10 years 40% of the spending power of social assistance has been lost through direct cuts and through inflation.
And in fact, the Income Security Advocacy Center has gotten behind that figure, haven't they?
That's quite correct. And so in that situation, what may originally have been thought of as a supplement available to people in fairly exceptional circumstances became, from the standpoint of protecting people's health, a prescription that really fitted the bill for every one of the 760,000 people on social assistance.
Right.
The reality is that in order to provide for yourself and for your family, if that's the situation, an adequate and nutritious diet, as the Ontario Ministry of Health would itself define it,
right,
you need the supplement.
Right.
Therefore, it's not an unreasonable process of thinking that larger and larger numbers of medical professionals have embraced that, from the standpoint of defending people's health, the supplement was a necessity.
You've raised a number of interesting points that bear questioning, and I'm going to try and hold them in my mind before we go on. First of all, the Ministry of Health, how do they define
adequate diet. Do they use the food basket concept?
In my understanding, and I certainly haven't done any extensive research regarding the Ontario Ministry of Health standards, but I believe that they work by a similar process to the Canada Food Guide, which is based, I understand, on a sort of a basket of goods kind of approach,
which doesn't include the things people often buy at the grocery store, such as razors or soap or deodorant or any of those things.
That's
just
quite
food,
correct.
Right? Yeah. So it's not even a grocery store guide. It's a guide for what goes into your mouth, right? And that's it.
Exactly correct.
So yeah. It's a very limited, narrow definition, and yet benefits have for some time. How long have they been unable to meet that definition? Have they always been unable to provide that kind of food?
Well, I think the reality is that from the very first days in 17th century England that they established workhouses for the poor, the intention has always been to ensure that the rates provided would be as abysmally low as they possibly could be.
Yes.
And that didn't change. The reality is that people in the early 90s who were living on social assistance were certainly living below the poverty line. But with the advent of an increasingly overt, what we might describe as a neoliberal economic and political agenda in the province, the driving down of social assistance rates in real terms has become, from the point of view of implementing that agenda, an absolute imperative. And that's why I think we've seen the cuts that took place under Harris, and those cuts being consolidated and deepened by McGuinty and her assistant in this matter, Sandra Pupatella.
Excuse me. I can cut that out. You also raised something about the doctor's role in this, or I can't recall, but it strikes me that the doctor's role in this is rather larger than has come to light in our interview so far. The OMA was apparently consulted on this, and I'm shocked that they would allow that some doctors feel intimidated because they're ignorant of the circumstances of the poor at being. I'm going to shut this door. Hang on. We're back. Some doctors felt intimidated, and on the basis of some doctors feeling intimidated because they don't know the circumstances of the poor, and they have people appearing in their office and telling them the circumstances and telling them the solution because the doctors don't know it themselves, they go to the OMA and say, you've got to stop this. And the OMA says, certainly. And then, you know, it reminds me of the... Maybe we can be lighter for just a moment. It reminds me of the statement made, I think it was around the turn of the last century, maybe just before it, in the United States, that the patent office should be closed because everything useful is already invented. And the hubris of a doctor who would say, we know everything about the role of nutrition in somebody's diet, and we know it enough to exclude everybody but the few people that we identify. And to do that, we need to identify everybody's illnesses,
yeah,
you know, and put them on government file.
Right.
I don't understand doctors doing this. I mean, my doctor certainly wouldn't do this.
No. Well, I think it needs to be said, and I'm really glad that this comes up, is certainly there have been dozens of health providers, including doctors, who have worked tirelessly, in some of them in the clinics that were organized, the community-based clinics where the diet supplement was prescribed, and some of them in their own private practice have worked very, very hard and done an incredible amount of work, and they're all to be congratulated. But at the same time, it needs to be said that there has been an enormous reservoir of conservative, almost poor bashing within the medical profession, and that surfaced around these complaints of so-called harassment of doctors that came to the Ontario Medical Association. And the Ontario Medical Association's role in this has been shameful from the standpoint of the treatment of the poor, but also a travesty in terms of any concept of democracy and respect for members of their own profession. The reality is that the OMA chose to collaborate with Pupatello and the Liberal government in designing this incredibly restrictive new policy.
Yeah.
And at the same time, deliberately, despite requests while it was proceeding, deliberately excluded those frontline doctors that were actually involved in providing the supplement to people. So the OMA needs to be called to task, and its behaviour has been absolutely shameful, and they should hang their heads in shame for their role in this.
Well, I have to tell you, it's been, I don't know how long it's been going on. It's been going on as long as I've needed medical care, which has been, you know, some 50 years, that 50 plus years. But the OMA and the CPSO have never been friendly towards nutritional medicine, have never been friendly even towards environmental medicine. And they've always done this. They've always extracted from their membership a few conservative, narrow-minded members to pass judgment on people who need these kinds of treatments and deprive them of support for them. And that this has spread from the CPSO to the OMA probably shouldn't surprise me, but it does. I don't, you know, it's funny, people say give these organizations independence, we can't afford to politicize them, but I don't see how they could get much more politicized. And I don't see the means of putting them back on track.
No, I mean,
There's got to be one, but it's very hard to foresee.
Right. Well, I think there will be interesting debates and struggles within the various bodies that represent and even regulate medical professionals, and that will be very healthy. But it isn't, of course, primarily the area in which we're going to be able to challenge this. We're going to challenge it on the basis of the political decision that was made by the people governing out of Queen's Park, and that's where we're going to have to focus our attention. But I must say, should the OMA be exposed, shaken up and forced to come to terms with what it's done, that would be a very healthy side effect to the whole thing.
Yeah, and it seems almost an inevitable side effect if you're to be successful.
Right.
I understand there's also an issue around privacy. I mean, these illnesses are being disclosed, or proposed to be disclosed, to the government as it reviews special diet benefits. And so now we're creating a file outside of doctors' offices, even outside of OHIP's offices.
No, I mean, not just the government in the sense that it's going to go to some private file somewhere. These forms are going to have to be turned into to welfare and ODSP offices. And people are going to have to declare medical conditions that they certainly wouldn't normally want to have medically unqualified welfare workers pass judgment on.
Well, that's true, too.
I mean, including HIV/AIDS, which now has to actually be declared as a condition and then handed over to a welfare worker for God knows what ramifications and assumptions.
We had Gary Block on the show here a while ago, interviewing him before the decision came down. I understand he's filed against this requirement?
He has. He's actually taken a complaint up with the privacy commissioner.
Oh, okay.
And I think that's a very. I mean, the reality is, I think if we're going to tackle this, OCAP's role primarily is to mobilize people directly affected in communities under attack. But we are very glad to see this thing being challenged at all different levels by all kinds of different people. So we have Gary's complaint to the Privacy Commissioner, and then we have more and more organizations that aren't immediately representative of poor people starting to speak out as well, and that's really, really healthy.
Yes, I've noticed that people who would normally not speak for the poor but are in a position to have mobilized behind this initiative.
Yes.
And the truth about the level of benefits for people on fixed incomes.
Yes.
Now, that 760,000 figure you mentioned, that includes ODSP, doesn't it?
Yes, it does, yes.
But it doesn't include everybody with a disability. Many of them are on this 500 and some odd dollar welfare rate.
That's correct, yes. I mean, one of the unrepaired legacies of the Tory years was making it progressively harder for people to access long-term disability.
Have we got a bunch of Tories with red ties in Queen's Park?
Well, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, the common sense revolution
is alive and well.
Yeah, it represented a period in which there was an intense dismantling of the social infrastructure, and McGuinty has come to power on an entirely hypocritical and false promise to change things, and I think his strategy is perhaps not to cut as directly and deeply as the Tories have done. The bulk of their work was completed, but at the same time to allow to consolidate the common sense revolution, to allow the effects of it to compound with the passage of time. Yeah. So it is, for example, that McGuinty made an incredibly modest election promise, insofar as he got into any specifics, to index social assistance payments to the cost of living. And he's even reneged on that that very, very tiny and inadequate promise that he made. Hence, when McGuinty leaves office, unless we can change that, which we're certainly working on, you'll be in a situation where people are actually worse off at the end of the Liberal regime than they were at the beginning of it, hence at the end of the Tory years.
And now from the original interview, in honor of McGuinty's poverty reduction plans to be announced after the election, Tom Waits. What's he building in there?
What's he building in there? What the hell is he building in there? He has subscriptions to those magazines. He never waves when he goes by. He's hiding something from the rest of us. He's all to himself. I think I know why. He took down the tire swing from the pepper tree. He has no children of his own, you see. He has no dog. He has no friends. And his lawn is dying. What about all those packages he sends? What's he building in there? With that hook light on the stairs. What's he building in there? I'll tell you one thing, he's not building a playhouse for the children. What's he building in there? And what's that sound from underneath the door? Pounding nails into a hardwood floor, and I swear to God I heard someone moaning low. And I keep seeing the blue light of a TV show. He has a router and a table saw. And you won't believe what Mr. Stitches saw. There's poison underneath the sink, of course. There's also enough formaldehyde to choke a horse. What's he building in there? What the hell is he building in there? I heard he has an ex-wife in some place called Mayor's Income, Tennessee. And he used to have a consulting business in Indonesia. What's he building in there? He has no friends, but he gets a lot of mail. I'll bet he spent a little time in jail. I heard he was up on the roof last night signaling with a flashlight. And what's that tune he's always whistling? What's he building in there? What's he building in there? We have a right to know.
Ernie Lightman suggested that the Liberals simply don't regard these voters as contributing to Liberal fortunes, and yet there's 760,000 of them. And then there's their families.
Yes.
And then there's the people who care for them, doctors and, yes. and whatever, other professionals. How is it that they can be so – is it that they're basically implementing Americanization of social services that they – that I mean, they can't be blind to this abrogation of support from these voters, because I'm sure all but a very few of them voted Liberal in the last election or NDP.
Yeah.
And it's essentially a swing vote, because these people, all the people on fixed incomes are desperate to survive.
Yes.
So it's a swing vote. Why are they not courting it?
Well, I think it has to be understood that governments, while they may have to make tactical shifts in this or that direction based on voter discontent or voter approval, they are actually implementing an agenda. It's an international agenda. It's been described as neoliberalism, and it really is to transfer wealth to those who are already richest in society, and to do that primarily through the profits of corporations.
I see.
And I think that the dismantling of social programs, especially income support programs for people who are unemployed and poor, is a very, very key part of that strategy. And so, McGuinty, of course, would, and even more skillfully, Pupatello would talk a good line about addressing poverty and all these things. But the fact is that if you're going to pay people extremely low wages, you cannot have a situation where the alternative is a welfare check that will actually put some level of groceries on the table for families.
Well, that's true, because a basic wage at a large multinational retailer won't even allow people to eat and pay rent.
No.
You have to be married to be able to work there, or you have to have a rent subsidy or something.
No, that's right. I mean, if you take the income of a single person on Ontario Works, which at the moment stands at $536 a month maximum.
Right.
If you have a situation where somebody's facing that, then the reality is that they're going to be forced to take any kind of employment, even under the table employment, even one that pays below the minimum wage, even one that denies them any basic rights as defined by the Employment Standards Act.
Right.
But if somebody has a $250 special diet supplement on top of that, then they're in a position to make some choices about where they're prepared to work and how they're prepared to be treated, and that's really the name of the game. I'm convinced that it's not about voter sympathy, and it's not in the end about saving money. Carol Gore in the Toronto Star made the point that to index social assistance rates to inflation would this year have cost less than the government gave away as a direct giveaway to Casino Windsor. So, I mean, it isn't primarily a fiscal question. It's about the kind of societal, economic, social changes that they're trying to implement.
I see. Well, you make a convincing case. So there doesn't seem to be a political solution. I mean, I know OCAP isn't overtly partisan, and on our show we try not to be partisan as well, although it's hard to know if it's even worthwhile being partisan these days. But, the only people who would promise a solution to this feel so entitled about wearing the white hats that they would be immune to criticism if they replace the Liberals as well. And I can't see a major three-party political solution to this problem. It seems like an organization like yours is the only answer, and the people that you mobilize to uncover the truth.
Well, I mean, there's this sort of, sometimes there's an assumption that something like social assistance or unemployment insurance or whatever we may be dealing with was somehow planned by governments because they wanted to operate in the on behalf of the general good of the citizenry. But the reality is that these programs came into existence primarily because of the organized discontent of people who were denied the benefits of such programs, and they were won on that basis. And it seems to me a logical extension of that proposition to say that in a fight like the fight to preserve the special diet supplement or win a substantial increase in social assistance rates in lieu of it, it's really going to come down to a question of whether those directly affected acquiesce or rebel against the situation.
Yes. Yeah. How was the rally that you were at yesterday?
It was actually a really impressive rally. We mobilized a crowd of we think just slightly in excess of 600 people.
And it was focused on the special diet.
It was focused entirely on the special diet, and the numbers of people that came out was it was encouraging for a relatively short period of mobilizing effort, but what was...
Well, it was encouraging, but just before the checks come out, too, when everybody's stuck at home for lack of money for transit tickets and... Yeah.
That's true. But what was more impressive was actually the makeup of the crowd.
I mean,
this was not a crowd of your standard standard activists, although we're certainly not sneering at people. We want all people to come out and join us. But,
yeah.
But it was a crowd made up overwhelmingly of people directly affected. In terms of Toronto's mobilization around the special diet supplement, people from the Somali community have been absolutely at the backbone of it.
Really?
And their presence in the thing was, you know, was really, really, really striking and really, really powerful.
Wow. Do we have – so where are the doctors with this now? Did Gary Blocks filed with the privacy commissioner, the other doctors?
Yeah, I mean
– they're behind him or they have their own initiatives?
Well, I think, you know, the medical providing community is somewhat split on this. We are seeing more – I think a larger and larger number of medical professionals, including doctors, who are very sympathetic and are ready to speak out. There's plans afoot to organize through the medical allies a town hall meeting.
Oh, in Toronto.
And those kinds of things will be very, very good. But I don't think we can say that we have the overwhelming sympathy of those in the medical profession and especially the doctors, that conservative attitudes have been a major issue all along. We did. The figures show that during the course of this year, there was an additional $40 million in special diet supplement money that was given to people.
Mm-hmm.
So there was certainly no lack of decent-minded doctors and other medical providers.
So the increase this year, or the total amount?
Yes, it went from $40 million to $80
million. Wow, okay.
Yeah, so no, it was a very substantial – I mean, that isn't to say that our campaign directly created that $40 million, but
no.
Certainly the word of mouth in poor communities that accrued from it, I think, was responsible for that situation.
Right.
And, so I think that, you have seen medical providers in substantial numbers coming out and standing in solidarity with the poor, but we've also unquestionably – as impressive as that figure may sound on the face of it, the reality is that if even a slim majority of doctors and other medical providers had been ready to assist people, the special diet supplement would have been something that not just some tens of thousands of people, but in fact hundreds of thousands of people would have had access to.
Right. Can we? Look to you for updates as this progresses. I can give you an email address, or should we call you from time to time and inquire? Because in Hamilton here, most of the news that I get is secondhand or through the papers and is such often stale slanted.
We certainly you're welcome to call, and whether just to get information or do interviews or at any time. But beyond that, you might like to just go to our website and get yourself put on our email list.
All right.
And then we'll certainly, that way you'll keep directly updated on everything that's happening.
So I take it this is something that all of that a listener could do as well. They could go to your website, www.ocap.ca.
That's right.
And there they could find a dialogue box or a checklist to get on your mailing list.
That's right, yes.
Oh, I think that's important. Before I turn the last comments over to you, how is... Until this protest with the privacy commissioner or some other measure takes effect to stop this legislation, what effect can people on benefits expect to see?
Well, just really a huge return at the moment, I'm afraid, to poverty and hunger.
Are they literally going to rescind all the special diet benefits for review?
Yeah, well, first of all, the door is going to be closed on new applicants and has been already.
Yep.
But, yes, I mean, people are going to be... start to get the new forms in the mail, and that most people won't be able to comply with, and even if they do, would only provide them a tiny fraction of the $250.
So on top of the 40% cuts, we're going to see, for these people who get the special diet, we're going to see another $250 a month, essentially, cut.
Absolutely. It's going to have a disastrous impact on a lot of people.
So evictions and homelessness and...
Well, that's been the
and medical problems.
Absolutely, and that's been the factor in creating so many evictions, is the fact that the only way people can put enough food on the table for their own families is to go short on the rent, and that's been why this has been happening, and it's going to happen much more now, and everybody that was getting the special diet is going to get their forms in the mail, and then they have 90 days to...
Nobody's exempt.
Nobody will be exempt. They will systematically move through the entire population of people that's getting the...
So even people who've been promised that their entitlement is permanent are going to be now reviewed.
Will, I'm afraid, count for nothing.
Yeah.
And mind you, that's, of course, I stress, that's what the government intends. Whether the government is actually going to get away with this attack, I think in OCAP we're pretty, we feel a great sense of optimism and confidence that we can actually beat this thing, because we've never seen people so ready to mobilize, so energized, so determined to defend themselves and their families. And that's, I think, going to be the deciding factor. And I don't frankly know if McGuinty and Pupatello have the stomach for what's coming down.
No. Well, I hope not. Yeah, what would you like to say to the interview that hasn't been addressed?
The only thing I'd like to perhaps conclude on is that I think that during all the years when Harris and Eves were in power, there was horrendous damage done to the gains of a lifetime, really, in this province. And there's a real opportunity now to start to win some of that ground back, like a decisive victory around the special diet supplement, to win its restoration or to win a very, very significant increase in social assistance rates, would be a very, very infectious kind of a victory. And it would open the door for people who are organizing around workplace conditions, people who are organizing around the issues of injured workers, a whole big array of very pressing issues in this province could be opened up. And if we can lead the way through that opening and win a victory on this front, there's no reason why we can't win a lot more victories on a lot of issues.
Good. As an aside, I don't know if you feel entitled to make a comment. Do you think a federal Liberal stalemate will have any effect, positive or negative, on the provincial Liberal position politically, strategically?
I mean, I think the electoral situation in Ottawa might limit room to manoeuvre to some degree at at Queen's Park, and that's healthy. The less confident and sure-footed they feel, the better.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I firmly believe that, in all honesty, the attack on social assistance is something that really governments are going to proceed with it regardless.
I see.
And I think it's going to be the question is going to really be the communities affected by it. Are they going to resist or not resist? And that's really what I think is going to be decisive. I mean, I'm not suggesting that there isn't a significant difference between, let's say, the Conservative Party and the NDP. But on the other hand, I think it would be a mistake to think that there's any conceivable political formation that's going to come in at Queen's Park that's going to turn the clock back without an awful lot of prodding from the community.
Right. All right. What can you recommend people do? First of all, they can sign up for your newsletter.
Certainly can. And we would like to see people speak out on this issue in every way they conceivably can, to contact Sandra Pupatello, the minister, send letters, have organizations put in resolutions. And we also hope that people will actually join us in mobilizing. One of the things that we need to do for sure is mobilize to actually, on short notice, confront these government figures at their public events. And so we want to build up a real sort of rapid deployment kind of a mobilizing capacity.
All right.
And people that want to be involved should certainly contact us.
I see. Okay. And does that include people outside Toronto?
Well, it certainly does. I mean, the fact is that, you know, it's an unfortunate reality of the way society is planned, that the big center seems to get all the attention and the focus. But this is a provincial government, and if they're only being challenged in the one ultra-major urban center and not being challenged throughout the province, that's going to weaken our campaign considerably. We need people everywhere, from northern Ontario right through to be engaged in this campaign.
Well, the little clicks that you've heard while I've been talking to you, I've been guilty. I've gone on your website, and I think it was about 4 clips to get to the subscribe to OCAP, so I can encourage the listeners to do that. It's not a difficult thing to do.
All right.
Yeah. I appreciate your time with me today.
No, thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
Thank you so much, Jeff.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
As I did during the previous airing of this interview, I'm going to give you a number to record. Get a pencil now. This is the number where you can find out what number to call to remove your medical records from Ontario's eHealth. This is the first place ODSP is going to look for them when they want to check your special diet. If you have to sign the special diet form, giving them permission to breach the medical confidentiality of your records, but you don't particularly want to make it easy, call this number, 1-888-789-4199. Again, that's 1-888-789-4199. Your key to some degree of medical privacy.
Disrespect welcomes Michael McMillan, former executive chair of Alliance Atlantis Media and co-founder of Samara Canada, to talk about his time with a food hamper from the Stop Community Food Center and how it affected his life while he was on it. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. I'm glad to be here. Even before I describe the reactions, almost the most important thing to point out is that it was a PR stunt, you know. I mean, none of us were under any illusion that we were going to find out what it was really like to be on welfare.
Right.
And, you know, 7 days is not an accurate picture. It was an activity designed to draw attention to the plight of those on social assistance, and we can't really leave. I couldn't leave my happy bourgeois life behind in 7 days and really get an accurate picture. So that's got to be, you know, made clear right up front that this is only a slight passing glimpse. Having said that, the response that I had was pretty much like the others too. You know, after 4 or 5 days eating what one would be able to eat on welfare, we all became not only hungry but more surprisingly irritated and irritable.
And tired.
And tired and sluggish and couldn't really think straight.
Mm-hmm.
And so the impact of eating a diet that was low on fruits and veggies and low on quality protein was pretty clear.
Yeah. Well, I remember discussing with Jonah Shine at the Stop how this exercise was playing out, and it wasn't getting a lot of press, although a lot of people were trying it, and there was some question as to the impact it was having, but it had been going on for a year. And I'm very pleased to see this experiment, and I understand that it can't replicate life on social assistance, but it can replicate life on a food hamper, which is only meant to last 3 or 4 days. And that's assuming that you're replicating the eating habits, I guess, of someone who's run out of food towards the very end of the month and has gone to the food bank or the community food center at the Stop and gotten something to get you through. You also mentioned that you were something of a cook. Have you been a foodie for a while?
I am a very keen cook. I cook every day,
mm-hmm.
and virtually every day, and I'm good at it, and I enjoy it, and that's why I do it all the time. And I've always fancied that I could, and generally I am able to make a very nice meal out of not a lot.
All right.
If I need to. It turns out that I never really understood what not a lot was until last
Sorry.
Week.
Yeah.
You know, and the lack of variety, mm-hmm. the heaviness or the preponderance of
carbs
and including some processed carbs like processed oatmeal and like instant oatmeal and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Is not a selection of foods that I would ordinarily make, so it was difficult to make appetizing, let alone healthy meals if one basically had carbs and not a lot of fruits and veggies and not a lot of, you know, good protein.
When was the last time that you yourself would have, as a student or in whatever situation, would have embraced Kraft dinner as food?
I've never really embraced Kraft dinner as food.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as a student, I ate, in hindsight, probably poorly. But
right.
By hook or by crook, I always was able to, and I guess wanted to eat fruits and vegetables.
Right.
So, you know, that I've never been a Kraft dinner person.
Okay.
But on the other hand, even as a student, low those many years ago, I always had more than the equivalent of the current $4.50 a day, mm-hmm. or whatever it is that, well, that's what it is that those on welfare get. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, the point of this exercise is that the welfare payment of $590 a month includes a portion that's allocated specifically for rent,
yeah.
about $360, and that's mm-hmm. for rent only. And if you save on that through some miracle, you can't allocate it to something else.
Yeah, and basically the going rate for a room is about $400, isn't it? And
well,
up?
I suppose probably more than that.
Yeah.
So, but whatever it is, that amount is put for rent. If one then takes off the cost of a Metro Pass, a TTC Metro Pass in Toronto, for example.
It's over 100 now, isn't it?
115 or something like that.
Yeah.
One's left with about $115 for everything else.
Mm-hmm.
So think about that, you know, $4 a day, basically,
mm-hmm.
for everything,
mm-hmm.
for food, for clothing, for, you know, medical stuff, drugs, for everything.
Yeah.
$4 a day. And the Medical Officer of Health of Toronto and most big cities in Ontario put out an annual statement whereby they politely yell at us and say, here's what every individual in Ontario ought to eat,
mm-hmm.
some fruits and veggies and so on, and the minimum to stay alive healthily would cost $8 a day.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I spend more than that on food, and I bet you do too.
Yeah.
But the minimum for a proper intake of food to be alive and healthy, $8 a day. So when we only...
This comes from the Medical Officers of Health in major cities.
Yep.
Okay.
And in fact, Dr. David McEwen, who is the Toronto Medical Officer of Health, went on this welfare diet with us.
Oh, I see that. He lost 5 pounds.
Yeah. And so his advice is we have to spend at least $8 a day for this minimum safety of food.
And that doesn't include eating out or
no.
social eating.
That's right.
Yeah.
It includes no booze, no restaurants. Well, it includes all the food you get take in, but you could have one meal out for that.
Yeah.
Is it little wonder that on $4 a day,
mm-hmm.
which is all the money in total available for a welfare recipient after rent and after a Metro Pass, well,
mm-hmm.
you know, it doesn't add up. It's not possible to eat
McEwen,
a healthy diet.
McEwen's quoted here, in work settings, family settings with friends, I couldn't join in with the food that was part of the events. So there's a sense of isolation that you get when you're not able to be a part of what others who have more resources are enjoying. And, of course, in this situation, almost everybody has more resources. So you can't be a part of almost any event.
No, that's right. You're isolated and you end up staying at home, not participating. And what's the purpose of giving somebody a welfare support? Presumably, not to kick them when they're down,
right.
but to help them get up
and
have them, you know, tied them through so they can find the job and restore the dignity that they once had, become a working member of society again, ideally sooner and not later. And if your entire budget, apart from rent and transit, is $4 a day, it's not going to be very easy to do that, to find that job, to be part of a dignified social, you know, setting with one's family and friends. And I certainly found that.
Yeah.
It was impossible. In fact, when I went off, when I finally fell off the wagon, as they say, on my fifth day, I had run out of food, and I was run down, and I couldn't think straight, and I was really, you know, irritated with the whole thing. But I went back onto my regular diet after that, and I had three oranges and an apple and a bunch of leftover cooked vegetables that my family had in the fridge. And within a day, I felt better.
Yeah.
And it was a direct response to eating a healthy intake of food. So it is kind of weird that we expect those on welfare to survive on something that the medical officer of health says is impossible and unhealthy.
And also seems... emotionally unhealthy as well.
Yeah, and Dr. McEwen provided us with some interesting statistics about how the use of the health care system
mm-hmm.
is much greater by those in poverty.
Yeah,
so
we're using it as an interventionist system rather than a maintenance or preventive system.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And that's expensive, as anybody
knows.
Very
expensive.
Yeah.
So it's a curious, even if one had, a draconian Dark Ages view on the poor, it still wouldn't make sense.
Because you'd save money by treating them better.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, it was started back in the early 90s by Mike Harris, who decided that a lot of people were cheating welfare, and he was going to move the rate down low enough that you couldn't live on welfare to encourage people to get off. But I don't think anybody thought about this recession, or people who face obstacles, such as people who are waiting to get on Ontario Disability Support and can't, get a regular job for one reason or another. Mental problems, addiction problems, I can't begin to list all the reasons that people have difficulty getting back to work. And it would be nice if they had some help, as you said, instead of some more obstacles to put in their way.
I'm pretty sure that everybody on welfare wants to get off. I can't see anybody saying, gee, I really want to be on welfare where the total money I have per day after shelter and transit is $4 for my entire budget. That's hardly a gravy train. That's hardly a lifestyle that anybody would wish for. And I must say it upsets me a lot when people say, well, folks just like that welfare lifestyle. As Nick Saul, who runs the Stop Community Food Center in Toronto, says, there's very little life and absolutely no style on welfare. So this allegation that the poor are enjoying the lifestyle or somehow are morally lesser than the rest of us is a Dark Ages view on life that I would urge us all to push back against. So, admittedly, the Harris government did cut back, and that was just a bloody shame that they did. But since then, the current government has not increased the payments in keeping with inflation. So they have, in fact,
declined
significantly compared to the necessities of life that the welfare payments are designed to try to partly cover, at least.
Yeah.
So there's lots of blame to go around all over the place. But, those cuts back in the 90s under Harris were significant.
It seems they're going to take a while to recover from, too. I spoke with someone in the federal government about this, was it yesterday or today, and mentioned the protest in Queen's Park. And they said, they're, another protest to the wrong people, which won't achieve anything. And I said, what do you mean? You don't feel Queen's Park supports the budget for welfare? And he says it's only 50%. He said the other 50% is municipal. And that was something I wasn't fully aware of. I knew a portion of it was municipal, but I had no idea it was a full 50%. So that the cities themselves seem to be complicit in this level of welfare, but it's a chicken and egg thing, right? I mean, city's not going to say, we'll stand to 60% if they want to up it, right? The province has got to go along and the cities have got to go along. Neither one seems to be willing to discuss the issue.
Well, that's right. And, I mean, sadly, those who are welfare recipients don't exactly have a strong voice.
No, that's right.
It's not as if, most of us in society, when our issue is under attack, if we think that we're getting the short end of the stick, generally speaking, there is some voice for us through our community groups, through our employers, through our associations,
neighborhoods, and other property owners. Yeah,
exactly. But those on welfare are, unable by and large to have their views heard. And that's, of course, the great indignity of assuming that, that they won't speak up. They won't be able to, protest for their basic human dignity and rights. And that's kind of the really frustrating part of this. And that's what attracted me to want to be part of this PR stunt.
Okay.
Try and raise that voice.
Yeah. Well, I wonder if that's behind the political stalemate on this issue, that poor people don't vote, or poor people move around, so I don't have to worry they'll be in someone else's riding or constituency or ward next time. I've often wondered about that, what the attitude to the poor is, because the poor have the same vote as anybody else, and they're increasingly politicized, as the Stop Community Food Center has shown. But no one seems to think that the vote of, I don't know how many people are on benefits, but I'll bet it's 500,000 anyway, in southern Ontario. No one seems to think that 500,000 votes seems to make any difference to them, personally or politically.
Yeah, and you know what? Even if the votes do make a difference or don't make a difference, one might consider what the individual human dignity of each one of those people, one by one, how much that matters.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd submit that matters completely.
Well, it happens that the individual I spoke to is someone living on Ontario Disability Support until the next week or so, and they got a government contract, and they're going to be running the equivalent of a small junior government ministry, because they've been doing this work for years, 7 years, without pay. And that gives you an idea of the caliber of people that we have on fixed incomes. I mean, they range all the way from people who belong on Ontario Disability Support because they can't take care of themselves, to people who are on Ontario Disability Support, who are at least as good as their counterparts in government, and the government recognizes that. And yet, you know, 7 years. 7 years, this guy living on $1,000 a month, doing the government's work. I still have a hard time putting that together. There seems to be an underestimation at the provincial and municipal level. The federal government seems to see, and I can share this with you and the listener, seems to see that a large part, or an important constituent part of dealing with our looming pension and seniors' debts as the baby boomers grow older is to tap people with disabilities as an untaxed employment market, and that the federal government seems to see the need to support them and bring them into society and enable them to generate income, if only so that it can be taxed and we're not left with a problem like they've got in the States when the baby boomers retire. Their baby boom, I think, is 5 years younger or older than ours. For some reason, I don't understand. Their baby boom started with a bang in about 1945, 46, and ours didn't really get rolling till the late 40s and 1950.
Actually, the largest the year of the greatest birth in Canada was 1962, I believe.
Oh, okay.
Which is much later than you would think.
Yeah, and that'd be the very tail end of the baby.
Very sharply right after that. But in any event, you know, however one measures this, the boomers are numerous,
mm-hmm.
and they're entering their retirement years
mm-hmm.
shortly,
mm-hmm.
and they will need to be looked after.
Yeah, and we need all these people at work who we're stomping on right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway, I think that the... this welfare diet that we did 10 days ago, I hope that it focuses the issue on the things we've just been discussing, and about the plight of those in poverty, our responsibility to treat them with dignity.
Yeah.
It's in our self-interest. It's unhealthy for all of us if we don't. And the way we've been talking about this is a much more productive way than the alternative, which is a conversation about, you know, food banks and do they give out the right food or not. I mean, it's a real shame that we have any food banks at all in this country. They are merely a stopgap. They are merely the final, you know, possibility for food when all else has run out.
Yeah.
And so it's not about food banks. It's about our public policy
mm-hmm.
around whether or not and how we think it's important to be supportive to those who most need it. That's the issue, not about how food banks are run.
I thank you for bringing that to our attention, and I'm impressed that you decided to participate in this.
despite that you live in one of the better parts of Toronto. You also are a co-founder of a charity of your own, aren't you?
Yes, of Samara.
What is Samara?
Samara is a very small Canadian charity that I co-founded a couple of years ago with my colleague Allison Lote. And our purpose is to increase the awareness of Canadians and the interest in Canadians in participating in sort of the public policy development. So we're looking at citizen engagement, at public affairs, journalism, and political leadership. This is all out of the view that public policy matters, and if we get it right, it's great, and if we get it wrong, it's terrible, and that we have to pay attention to sort of communal solutions, or common solutions, in the village green, if you will, and not merely rely on individualized actions separately, one from each other. So basically that public policy matters, and we should care about politics and policy.
I appreciate that. Is there a website that the listener can go to?
If you Google Samara or Samara Canada, you get it there.
Okay.
Great.
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Super. See ya.
You've been listening to Michael McMillan, co-founder of charity Samara Canada and former executive chair Alliance Atlantis Media, with his experience of eating from a food hamper from the Stop Community Food Center in Toronto, which lasted 4 days, although as an experienced cook, he'd hoped to make it last for seven, as part of the Stop's Do the Math program to show people how long the $590 available on Ontario Works lasts once you pay the rent.
Once upon a time, there was a poor child with no father and no mother. And everything was dead. And no one was left in the whole world. Everything was dead. And the child went and searched day and night. And since nobody was left on the earth, he wanted to go up into the heavens. And the moon was looking at him so friendly. And when he finally got to the moon was a piece of rotten wood. And then he went to the sun. And when he got there, the sun was a wilted sunflower. And when he got to the stars, there were little golden flies stuck up there like the shrike sticks them on the black thorn. And when he wanted to go back down to Earth, the Earth was an overturned piss pot. And he was all alone. And he sat down and he cried. And he is there to this day. All alone. Okay. There's your story. Night, night.
If you can't access a Disrespect broadcast, you can now listen to the show wherever you're near an internet download. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at showtime to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.